Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I found interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 9th of September 1923, an earthquake, an invasion, plans for the Holocaust, Nazis, hyperinflation, and cruelty to a cat. For light relief, if it can be called light relief, we have a conchie and a Prime Minister's memoirs. But first, the headlines. There are two huge stories this week. The first is that there has been a huge earthquake in the Tokyo region of Japan, with huge numbers of people being killed. But how many exactly? Or indeed roughly? This is from Monday. Bulletins from Japan report that 100,000 persons have perished in Tokyo and Yokohama alone. And this is from Tuesday. 300,000 lives lost. And Wednesday, 500,000 reported killed. Modern estimates, according to Wikipedia, are in the region of 100,000 to 150,000. Something very similar happened in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. If memory serves, estimates of the number of deaths topped out at about 10,000 before being steadily revised downwards to about 2,500. The second big story is that Italy has seized the island of Corfu. Last week, this being a story that I completely failed to pick up on, an Italian general investigating where the Greek-Albanian border should be was assassinated along with his party. This has been used by Italy's leader, Benito Mussolini, as a pretext for the invasion. All this illustrates just how much trouble the treaty, or treaties, of Versailles are in. Turkey has succeeded in having its treaty overturned. Germany is not complying with its obligations, and although this case is outside the treaty, it is a clear breach of the principles of international law that many thought the treaties had laid down. In Germany, the mark which broke 1 million to the pound in early July, on Wednesday reached 77 million, and on Saturday 150 million. Or to put it another way, it has lost 99% of its value in 2 months. Last week I mentioned how the Poplar Board of Guardians was subsidising the dock strike by paying strike pay. I now discover that there's a bit more to the story of Poplar Poor Law Board. In 1921, the Guardians, the majority of whom were members of the Labour Party, refused to collect the money that they were supposed to transfer to the London County Council. They were jailed. This caused a furore, and the government backed down, creating the system that I described in which the rest of London subsidised Poplar. I am a libertarian. I would rather that there was no government welfare system at all. But if there is to be one, I have long felt it ought to be locally funded and managed. I believe that would lead to a more efficient allocation of resources. However, the subsidisation of Poplar is a clear breach of that principle. Another passed exam on the way to a PhD in national bankruptcy. In a letter published on Friday the 8th, Reginald Blair, Chairman, London Municipal Society and National Union of Ratepayers Associations, states that the payment of strike pay was probably illegal, but on current form, the responsible department, the Department of Health, I kid you not, would probably do nothing. On Thursday the 6th, we learnt that a man has been fined £5 for cruelty to a cat. At one point he said, "It is my cat and I can do what I like with it." Turned out he couldn't. They, as in we British, say we British are a nation of animal lovers. I thought that that was a relatively recent thing, but given this and any number of other cases I could mention, apparently not. One day this week, I failed to record which, not that it matters much, a war memorial was unveiled in Harrogate. There is nothing particularly special about the Harrogate War Memorial. I mention it solely to make the point that memorials are being unveiled up and down the country every week, a collective recognition of the sacrifice of the dead and the loss of the living. And I am sure a reminder to all who might need reminding that this must never happen again. War casts other shadows. This is from Tuesday the 4th. At the Sittingbourne Parliamentary Revision Court yesterday, Mr. A.D. Ablewhite, Conservative agent, objected to the vote of Mr. Percy Wells, the secretary of the local Labour Party, under Section 9 of the Representation of the People Act 1918, claiming that Mr. Wells was disqualified as a conscientious objector. quite right. Mind you, had he been a woman, this would never have arisen. On Saturday the 8th, a correspondent wrote this. Your leading article before breakfast rightly notes that the period before the postman arrives has not a name of its own. If you waited until the postman had arrived before having breakfast these days, you'd probably starve. I should point out that this is less a statement about Royal Mail efficiency and more one of the importance of the post in an age before the internet and for most people before the telephone. The Times and others have plenty to say about Italy's seizure of Corfu. This is from Saturday the 8th. Interviews with Signor Mussolini and Baron Avezzano, the Italian ambassador at the French capital, which have appeared in Paris newspapers, seem but to confirm what was already known as to the uncompromising attitude of the Duce, that's what he's calling himself, and his cabinet. The Italian Prime Minister is emphatic in his affirmation that nothing will make him draw back or accept a compromise with national honour. That's probably a compromise of national honour. Anyway, it goes on. And that his government will not allow the wrong done to Italy by the murder of her officers to be discussed and judged in the Assembly at Geneva, by which he means the League of Nations. The article goes on, or the editorial, goes on to mention the possibility of an Italian attack on Athens. The Italian Prime Minister undeniably stands in a difficult position, but he has shown so strong a sense of realities and so much adroitness in the past that we cannot yet believe that he will proceed to such extremes. The failure of fascismo would indeed be a disaster for Italy at this moment, as the failure of the League, as in the League of Nations, will be a disaster for the world. G.M. Trevelyan is best known, insofar as he is known at all, as the author of A Social History of England, History with the Politics Taken Out, as it's sometimes described. This is what he had to say, also from Saturday. What would be the result of attempting to force Italy before a tribunal whose authority she rejects when that tribunal does not even pretend to be able to make its pronouncement ultimately binding, if Italy, after hearing it, declines to abide by it? The dispute would not be settled. The friendship of Britain and Italy would be at an end. The League would lose the membership of Italy and a great deal of prestige from having attempted what it could not in fact achieve. He goes on to remind readers that the French occupation of the Ruhr, which was also of dubious legality, also did not end up in front of the League. This, of course, goes to the heart of the problem with the League. It claims that its decisions have the force of law, but it itself has no forces at its disposal. On Wednesday the 5th, the Times republished an extract from a message from the unnamed chief rabbi to mark the Jewish New Year, originally published in Jewish World. A world that was nearly destroyed by hate is seeking to save itself by hate, and Israel, I think he means the Jewish race, not the state, is the greatest sufferer in these distracted days. The forces of reaction and race hatred everywhere have joined hands in the unholy work of reviling and slandering the Jew. We are back once more in the Dark Ages. New Jewish massacres, and on an unprecedented scale, are openly advocated and systematically planned. So who might be doing this planning? Russian monarchists. Not quite the answer I was expecting. Russian monarchists declare that in the event of their regaining power, they will slaughter every Jewish man, woman, and child in that land. This may go some way to explaining how, when the time came in Russia and elsewhere, the Nazis had so many willing accomplices. Talking of Nazis, this is from Friday the 7th. At a time when many newspapers in Germany have been forced to cease publication, and others, owing to the enormous cost of production, are only able to continue with difficulty, Herr Hitler's paper, the Völkische Beobachter, has doubled in size and, with one exception, is the largest daily paper published in Bavaria. The fact that Herr Hugo Stinnes, the man who basically owns Germany, has recently been in Bavaria and was a guest of General Ludendorff while an important political conference was being held, sustains the report that Herr Stinnes himself has been persuaded to present a few of his milliards to the funds of the Hitler movement. General Ludendorff's association, Ludendorff was effectively Germany's military chief in the last 2 years of the war, with the Bavarian fascist movement has always been a matter of some dispute, and still is. For a time it was considered politic to disown the influence he exercised on their councils. But he's going to struggle to downplay this one. General Ludendorff's connection with the Hitler movement was amply demonstrated at the German Day at Nuremberg on Sunday last, in honour of the anniversary of Sedan. That was the key battle in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. Over 70,000 National Socialist stormtroops, the majority with uniforms and equipment, carried out a parade march, the Goose Step, and General Ludendorff and Herr Hitler, standing side by side, took the salute. And now for some ordinary, decent criminals. This is from Saturday the 1st. New Scotland Yard state that at 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, two employees of the National Health Insurance Office in Delaware Road, carrying satchels containing money, were held up by two men with revolvers. National insurance was a tax introduced before the war. In return, the taxpayers were entitled to GP services, old age pensions and the dole. Your occasional reminder that the welfare state did not begin in the late 1940s. It goes on. The two officials had been to the bank for money to pay the wages of the staff at the accounting section of the National Health Insurance Commission in Delaware Road, Maida Vale. Wages were often paid in cash in those days. It goes on. Three men who were standing near a motor car appeared to have been waiting for them when they arrived in Delaware Road in a taxicab. As the clerks alighted, two of these men came forward and, presenting revolvers, called out, "Hands up!" One of the men then made a grab at an attaché case carried by a clerk. And with this, the two men made off down Delaware Road. They were pursued by the two officials, and others joined in the chase. The men dashed down Warwick Avenue and turned into Formosa Street. There they doubled back into a narrow passage, Elnathar Mews. A number of people had by this time joined in the chase, and a few yards down the mews the two fugitives decided to stand at bay. The pursuers closed in on the two men, who pointed their revolvers and threatened to shoot anyone who approached. One of the fugitives, by threatening the crowd with his revolver, managed to work his way back into Formosa Street, where he escaped. The other, who had the attaché case, tried to get away in a motor car, but was surrounded and caught. Would a crowd be so brave today? You would have thought that a head of government at the outbreak of the First World War, and who had lived to tell the tale, would have quite the tale to tell. But in the case of Herbert Asquith, Britain's PM in August 1914, you'd be wrong. He's written a book, Genesis of the War, about the period, and if the Times Review is anything to go by, it's not a classic. A few weeks ago, I quoted from a speech given by Field Marshal Haig, in which he condemned Britain's lack of preparedness, that is, the small size of its army. This is what Asquith had to say on the question of raising an army. This is from Thursday the 6th. Everybody who lived in those times, and every historian who writes of them with adequate knowledge, will agree that there was only one answer to the question. Any government that proposed it would have committed political suicide. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.